This is the BC Youth Conference 2017. Our general theme for the week is Moses. Our speaker is Brother Jason Hensley. This is class number 2, entitled Terror in Egypt. Brother Jason.
Thank you, Brother Tim. Good evening, everyone. How are you now? Good? You're doing well? All right, here we go. So, here's our series outline. We are now in class number 2, Terror in Egypt. We're going through Exodus chapter 1. As you'll notice, starting tomorrow, our discussion groups will overtake our classes. However, that's okay. I think it was really nice, actually, that we talked about Exodus 1 this morning, because what we're going to try to do now is really go into a little more detail and just bring out some things maybe that you didn't think about. So, we are talking about humility in this series. And for this class, we are going to look at what it was like in Egypt before slavery. Oh. We're going to talk about a new creation, starting with Israel. And then we will look at Egypt's wrath and God's vengeance. Now, just something that I wanted to add on to last night's class. Remember the timeline? We looked at the timeline. We said there was 135 years from Jacob coming into Egypt to Moses' birth. 135 years, Jacob comes into Egypt, 135 years pass, Moses is then born. Well, you can actually take that further by looking at Joseph's death. Joseph actually died 71 years after Jacob came into Egypt. So if you take that 135, subtract 71, it takes you with, there were 64 years from the death of Joseph to the birth of Moses. That's pretty incredible. So just kind of think about that. So here's what we're looking at. Our core message. Do you remember yesterday's? True humility recognizes that God's ways are higher than man's ways. There you go. Good. It's okay. I had a hard time remembering it too. So true humility recognizes that God's ways are higher than man's ways. Today's is true humility waits for God's vengeance in that nice deep purple. True humility waits for God's vengeance. The why question is, why did Israel forsake Yahweh and worship foreign gods? Now, there's a lot of whys for that, but I think we'll get to that when we're talking about before the slavery, what it was like in Egypt before slavery took place. So during those 135 years, probably not during the time of Joseph, so really we could say during those 64 years, Israel began to worship Egyptian gods. I can't handle bad grammar. You know what? I'm going to fix it right now. Because otherwise I won't sleep. Just kidding. I actually will. Ha! Okay. All right, now we can move on. So, during those 64 years, Israel began to worship Egyptian gods. Now, why did that happen, right? That's our big why question. Why were they doing that, and exactly how did they do it? And what we want to take a look at when we're talking about before slavery is two main ideas. We want to consider what Egypt was like as a place. We don't often think this. I mean, if I were to say Egypt, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Pharaoh. Pyramids, camels, cats. Okay, all right, that's enough. Okay, so yeah, like you think of things like pyramids, you think of sand, right? Like maybe orange and yellowy colors, right? But Egypt actually was extremely fruitful at the time, so we want to get that in our heads. Then hybrid worship, we also want to see that. So these are the two aspects of Israel's existence in Egypt before the slavery that we really want to know. We want to see that Egypt was a fruitful land, and we want to actually recognize that, yes, Israel worshipped false gods, but they never actually stopped worshipping Yahweh. That's very interesting how this works. So they really try and create this kind of hybrid worship. So I guess, you know what, on this very slide that asks the why question, I just kind of answered it for you. The answer is they never actually did stop worshipping Yahweh. Alas. All right. So here we go. Let's talk about a fruitful land. Israelites are shepherds. Yeah, right? We remember that? And Egypt is a very good place to be if you're a shepherd. So come over with me to Genesis chapter 13, and let's note this. As we read this, look for the fruitfulness of Egypt. Genesis chapter 13. You remember the story? This is Abram and Lot. They're trying to decide who's going to go where because their herdsmen are bickering amongst each other. So this is the fruitfulness of Egypt. Genesis 13, starting at verse 7. Genesis 13, verse 7. Listen for it. And there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled then in the land. Abram said unto Lot, Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. All right, did you hear it? How is Egypt described there? Like the garden of the Lord, which means Garden of Eden, right? What we're being told here is Egypt was like the Garden of Eden, right? This is a ridiculously fruitful place. You know, this is the place where, like, you accidentally throw a seed on the ground and you're like, boom, tree, you know, like that kind of thing. Like, maybe not quite like that. But, like, you get the idea. This is not California, right? Everything dies because the sun kills it all. So, anyway, unless you have irrigation, which is what California has perfected. So, now, they were in the best part, right? So, it's like the Garden of Eden, and not only that, this is like being in the sweet spot in the Garden of Eden, right? They're shepherds, they want a fruitful place, and that's what they're in. So, if you take a look at Genesis 45, notice this. Genesis 45, this is the description of Goshen. Genesis 45, 17 to 18. Genesis 45, verse 17 says, Pharaoh said unto Joseph, Say unto thy brethren, This do ye, lead your beasts, and go get ye unto the land of Canaan. And take your father and your households, ready? And come unto me, and I will give you the good of the land of Egypt, and ye shall eat the fat of the land. So, they get the good of the land of Egypt. They are in Super Egypt. This is the place that you want to be if you are a farmer, if you are a shepherd. This is it. Numbers 11, it's a similar kind of thing. You remember the story about the quail, where God says, I'll give you so much quail, it comes out of your nostrils and all that? I always used to like that story. But what you get from that, well, have you ever thought about quail? Never mind. Don't think about it. You have to eat a lot of quail for it to come out of your nostrils. So, that's my profound thought for the day. Okay, Numbers chapter 11. Let's not get sidetracked. Numbers 11. This is the story about the quail, right? And in the quail story, the people are reminiscing about what they used to eat. You remember what they say? We remember the leeks, the garlic, the onions, fish. Yeah, they remember their fish too. So they remember those things, right? That's the kind of stuff that they had back in Egypt. In the wilderness, not so much. So this is what life was like, right? It's as though you were living in the middle of a famine, right? In the wilderness, and it's like taking an Amish person and sticking them in the middle of Las Vegas or something like that. Right? They'd be like, whoa, you know, what are all these things? All these flashing lights and everything, right? So I think that's kind of what we're looking at. They are taken from the wilderness, and they're plopped in this place that's like, boom, huge growth. So life was good. Life was comfortable. And so, you know, a lot of times that is really the perfect place for creating a climate of indifference. So that's one thing. And really, that's what happens. They start to worship these false gods. But what I want us to notice is, if you read Exodus chapter 1 carefully, you would see that Israel didn't stop worshiping Yahweh, because they never actually forgot Genesis 15. Listen to this very carefully. This is what Pharaoh says. See if you hear the promise of Genesis 15. Exodus 1, verses 8 to 10 says, "Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. He said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land." Do you hear the promise? Somehow, Pharaoh knows that even though they are in the good of Egypt, eating the fat of the land in a place that's like the Garden of Eden, that the Israelites want to leave. And not only do they want to leave, they intend to leave at some point. So throughout this, even when this new Pharaoh comes around, right, when they're there worshiping false gods, the Israelites are waiting. They know the promise of Genesis 15 exists. They know they're going to be there 400 years. They know it's going to be in the fourth generation. So they're ready. And even Pharaoh knows that. So somehow he expects them to leave. And thus, he does whatever he can to destroy their deliverer, right? We're familiar with that. The whole midwife deal, we'll get there. And then the whole thing, when the midwife issue does not work, he then tells his people, go and throw the children into the river. We'll talk more about that in detail. So, they were waiting. The children of Israel were waiting for their deliverer. They were waiting for somebody to take them out of the land. So the question then is, well, why were they so expectant of this? Yes, they knew Genesis 15, but there's a little more to it. Because if you remember, in Genesis 15, there were two indications of time. Right? We looked at one yesterday. What was it? How long would they be afflicted? 400 years. Yeah, so that's the first one. Here, look for the second one. Ready? Genesis 15, 13 to 14 says, "And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them. They shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge. Afterward shall they come out with great substance. In the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." So we already noticed this first one, this first indicator, the 400 years. What's the second one? Yeah, fourth generation, right? So that's not just the 400 years, but we're actually looking for the coalescing of 400 years and the deliverer being the fourth generation. So that's kind of interesting. Now, this is where it gets tricky, and this is something that God often does with prophecy. I don't know if you've noticed this, but he says things in such a way so that if you try and predict how it's actually going to happen, you usually don't do a very good job. So, for instance, if you read this and just read it at face value, you would assume that this is talking about in the fourth generation of the nation being in Egypt, they will come out. Only problem is, when they came out, it wasn't the fourth generation of the nation. It was the fourth generation of the deliverer. It was Moses' fourth generation, but not of the nation. And so you could just imagine people thinking, wow, it's our fourth generation, we're ready. And then the deliverer never comes, right? Then it comes the fifth. Fifth generation, we're ready. Oh. Sixth generation, oh, right? And finally, Moses comes in like the seventh generation of the nation, and he's still fourth, right? It was a weird phenomenon of just how like the births in his family worked. He ended up being the fourth generation when everybody else was like in their seventh. So we'll take a look at that. Ready? Here we go. Here's how you can work this out. So during the time of Joseph, turn please to Genesis chapter 50 and notice that in fact the fourth generation had actually been fulfilled in Joseph's lifetime. The fourth generation of the nation, that is, not of the deliverer. So Genesis chapter 50. Genesis 50, take close note of the generations that Joseph saw in his life. Genesis 50, starting at verse 22. Genesis 50, verse 22 says, "Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation." Okay, so that's one line, one branch here. Ephraim's children of the third generation, and the children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were brought up on Joseph's knees. So there's two branches here, right? Ephraim, Manasseh. How many generations in Ephraim did he see? Three generations of children, right, in Ephraim's line. And he saw, what was it? Machir, son of Manasseh's, what? Children. Okay, so let's work this out. Ready? So, Jacob is the first generation to come into Egypt, right? Make sense? First generation to come into Egypt. Second generation then is Joseph. Joseph then has Ephraim. Ephraim is a third generation. And how many generations of Ephraim's children? Three. That means that by the time of Joseph's death, Ephraim's family was in the sixth generation. Whoa. Now, you then do the same thing with Machir, the son of Manasseh. So you have first generation is Jacob, second is Joseph, third is Manasseh. Machir is Manasseh's son, so he's the fourth. And then this is the fifth generation that Joseph sees. So by the time of Joseph, families are already passing the fourth generation. Youch. I'll give out the slides too, by the way, at the end. I'll have a little stick. Okay, and so you can just picture, even during Joseph's time, right? He says at the end, God will surely visit you. We looked at that yesterday. And then he emphasizes it again. God will surely visit you, so don't forget to bring my bones. He had to emphasize that to them, I think, because the people were like, fourth generation, hey, well, I'm like sixth generation, and we're starting to have kids, right? You know, like, this isn't looking so good. So by the time of Exodus chapter 1, it's interesting that some of you, I think, were talking today, how was it that Amram and Jochebed knew that Moses was a special child? I would put to you that one of the reasons, not the reason, but one of the reasons was probably because there were almost no families left that were still third generation and that were going to have a fourth generation. Okay, so here's how Moses works. Ready? Take a look. The genealogy of Moses is such. Exodus chapter 6. Exodus 6, starting at verse 16. Exodus 6, verse 16 says, "These are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations, Gershon and Kohath and Merari. The years of the life of Levi were 137 years." Skip to 18. "Sons of Kohath were Amram, Izhar, Hebron, Uziel. Years of the life of Kohath were 133 years." Verse 20, "Amram took Jochebed, his father's sister, his aunt, sweet, to wife. And she bare him Aaron and Moses." So when you work this out, what you get then is, right, first generation is Jacob, second generation is Levi, third generation is Jochebed, fourth generation is Moses and Aaron. Now, just to give you a comparison, take a look at this. If you work through the genealogy of Korah, right, Korah, so a contemporary of Moses, the guy who did all the bad stuff in the wilderness in number 16, Korah's genealogy says that he was Jacob, Levi, Kohath, Izhar, Korah, right? Korah was already in his fifth. Alas for Korah. Hur, the handholder. Hur. If you go through his genealogy, you find that it's Jacob, Judah, Perez, Hezron. Add that one in. Caleb. Hur is the sixth. And not only that, in the wilderness, Hur actually has a grandkid who's alive. Bezalel. So, while Moses is in his fourth generation, Hur's family is in their eighth. Okay, that's enough, like, beating this horse. You get the idea. Joshua's in the tenth. Actually, it's not enough. I just want to show you some more, because it's cool. Zelophehad is in the seventh. Okay, now that's really enough. So you get the idea, right? There were no more fourth generations. Moses was really it. Okay. So Israel is in an awkward situation because at this point they're expecting the promise and yet they're worshiping false gods, right? So they have this weird hybrid worship in that they still think God is going to deliver them and yet they are saying, oh, Egypt, who do you worship? Oh, that's interesting. Can you tell me about him? You know, and how do I follow them? But the thing is that I think it's important to recognize we are in a similar situation. that we have the same thing, economic prosperity. We have a society that is filled with tolerance and, well, apathy is our main key there. There are so many possibilities for idol worship. You remember what Colossians 3 verse 5 says about that? It says, and covetousness, which is idolatry. That verse is a scary verse, yeah. Apathy is essentially not caring about things, right? People say, oh, I don't really care. You know, you do what makes you happy. I'll do what makes me happy. Just don't bother me, right? That's apathy. So it's a similar kind of situation. Those were supposed to stay up there. Oops. It's a similar situation in which you have a economic prosperity, you have apathy and tolerance, and then you have easy ways of idol worship. Covetousness is everywhere, right? You look at Romans chapter 7, and the Apostle Paul is talking about the way in which the law made it impossible for you to not sin, and he goes through the commandments, and the specific one that he chooses to mention is, thou shalt not covet, because that's the one that everybody in life ever, throughout all time, has never been able to not break. In other words, everybody broke it. Covetousness, which is idolatry. And so we have idol worship in front of us today. It's the same situation. We are in the awkward situation of the Israelites of attempting to recognize the idolatry in our lives and to throw it out. And to see, in fact, that oftentimes we are involved in hybrid worship. Now, the next thing that happens, really, the beginning of the chapter, we talked about this a little bit in our discussion groups today. The beginning of the chapter starts with the little genealogy, right, of the 70 people that came into Egypt. And then the very next thing is Exodus 1 and verse 7. So let's turn there, Exodus 1 and verse 7, because we want to notice how Exodus really starts. So it gives us the genealogy, and then it immediately launches into this idea of the Israelites multiplying. Exodus 1 and verse 7. Here it is. 1:7 says, and the children of Israel were fruitful, increased abundantly and multiplied, waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now, in our intro today, we touched on this, but I just want to show it to you visually that there's a huge link between Exodus 1:7 and Genesis 1:28. Here it is on the screen. And so you'll notice that these words for fruitful are the same. That's para in Hebrew. Here's your Strong's number. 6509. Your word for multiply to the same, that's rava in Hebrew, 7235. Your word for land and earth, eretz. I just think eretz is such a cool word, by the way. Strong's number 776. And filled and replenish, same word, malah. Strong's number 4390. So these verses here are intimately connected, and this is, who is this referring to, Genesis 1:28, do you remember? Adam, yes, Adam and Eve, I think you could say. Adam and Eve. And so Exodus 1 verse 7 is essentially taking the commission that was given to Adam and Eve and giving it to, showing the Israelites fulfilling it, right? This was God's purpose, and now the Israelites are going to continue that purpose on. And so it's interesting then that, again, I'll give you the slides, so you can write furiously if you like, if you so desire. But I'm just warning you, this slide is intense. I felt overwhelmed looking at it this afternoon, so, and I made it. So here we go. Okay, ready? Here. So at Eden, God attempts to create a paradise in which righteousness reigns, right? That doesn't work with Adam and Eve because of the fall. However, what we see in Exodus chapter 1 is God starting this idea of a new creation. And I want to be careful with the phrase new creation because that's very much a New Testament idea, and that is what the Lord Jesus Christ is doing. But this was a new creation, not the new creation. Yeah. So, here's our connections. Take a look at this. He starts with 70. Remember how many people went down into Egypt as part of Jacob's family? It was 70. So it's very interesting that if you take a look at the nations then that exist right in the beginning in Genesis chapter 10, guess how many there are? There are 70. Actually, I need to be honest about this. I sat down and I counted them like five times because every single time I got a different number. and it was like 71 or 69 or 70. That frustrates me so much when I do that. And that happens like every year at 100th day at school. I can never figure out which day is 100th day. But anyway, I think it's 70 nations. It seems like it. And in Exodus 1:5, there were 70 who came into the land. God then commands them to be fruitful and multiply, as we saw. By the way, if you're wondering what the organization of these verses is, we're following the way in which they appear in Exodus. Okay, so this is 1 verse 5, this is 1 verse 7. Be fruitful and multiply. There's a serpent-like adversary. Notice that Pharaoh is described as being crafty and subtle. Oh, yeah. Crafty and subtle. There's then the birth of a son, right? So that's the creation of Adam. Then Moses, who are described as being good. Notice that. Then there's a test of obedience. Now, this comes a little later for Israel, right? This is Numbers chapter 14, when God's going to send them into the land. It's their test of obedience. Are they going to be faithful and say, yes, with God's help we can do this? Or are they going to fall, just like Adam and Eve did? And we know what happens. They fell, right? And thus they are given then the punishment of death. In Numbers 14:32, God says, all of those who did not believe will perish in the wilderness. And you know what happens in Numbers chapter 14? Check this out. This is the failure of Israel's creation, of the Israel creation, you could say. However, God is still going to fill the earth. And so what does he say in Numbers 14? Truly, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Right? This has been the purpose. Replenish the earth. Fill the earth. Right? He wants to fill the earth with people who are righteous. That's been the goal since Genesis 1. And so in Numbers 14, when Israel fails, God says, okay, Moses, I won't destroy them, but as truly as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. And it will be this time with the true deliverer, with the Lord Jesus Christ. And thus it's interesting that he's called the beginning of creation, right? Because he's the beginning of a new creation. He's called that in Revelation 3:14. It then starts with 70 disciples who are sent out to preach. And you have a multitude which no man can number, a group of people who have been fruitful, who multiply. And you see that in Revelation chapter 7. So anyway, I just think it's awesome to see this pattern. Shows up in Genesis, you follow it through with Israel, and then there's tons on the new creation. This is 3 points to whet your appetite. So, what's amazing about that is that this creation, the one that's not going to fail, the one that can't be messed up by Adam, the one that can't be messed up by Israel's unfaithfulness, is the one that has been offered to us. This is the new creation with the new Adam, the one who is heavenly, according to 1 Corinthians 15. So, that is Exodus 1:7. Now, as we move on in Exodus, we learn about the new Pharaoh who does not know Joseph. Now, I think there's a few things that are funny about it. Let's read Exodus 1, verses 8 to 10, and see if you notice anything that's a little bit odd regarding what we're told about this Pharaoh. Take a look. Exodus chapter 1, starting at verse 8. Something's missing. Exodus 1 and verse 8 says, now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. He said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. What's missing? What was that? Yeah, Pharaoh's basically missing from that. Did you notice we're like never told who Pharaoh is? Because that's how useless he is, right? You don't even need to know his name. So we're not told that. Now, he's a new Pharaoh. I think we're told he's this new Pharaoh because it's a contrast to God, who has been there since the beginning, right? Here's a new Pharaoh. So he's a new Pharaoh. He's not even important enough for us to know his name. He has no regard for Joseph at all. And for some reason, he doesn't want the Jews to leave, which is an interesting thing to think about, right? At this point, they're not actually slaves yet. He's the one who makes them slaves, but he is freaked out about the Jews leaving. And it sounds like the reason that he's that way is, you know, he thinks that they're going to join with their enemies and fight against Egypt, something along those lines. Another suggestion could be, so he fears the rebellion. Another one could be that it's interesting that where Israel was in Goshen, right? There's Goshen. Makes a very nice barrier for when any Canaanites decide to come and attack Egypt. Guess who they have to go through first? So, you know, maybe Pharaoh liked his little Israelite cushion and didn't want, you know, for them to leave. So for some reason. So that's what we know about Pharaoh. Okay, now as far as the promise goes, then, as we noticed last night, Pharaoh then causes them to be afflicted and to serve. It also mentions there in Exodus chapter 1, verses 11 to 14, that Israel was multiplied. The reason that I want to notice this is you will see, if you take a look at Genesis 15, that these terms here in Exodus 1, verses 11 to 14, all three of these terms, multiplied, afflict, and serve, all three of these come out of Genesis 15. Here's why this is important. These come out of Genesis 15. Genesis 15 is the promise. And I think it's awesome to see that here is where Israel, in these verses, is being made slaves. And yet in the slavery, in the verses describing their slavery, God is fulfilling his promise. So that even in persecution, God is clearly working in the record. And I just want to throw that out because I think sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we think we've been abandoned, or sometimes we just think God has disappeared. But even when things are getting so terribly bad that it feels like we're in slavery, God is still working just like he was here, fulfilling the promise. So now we get to the midwives. Oh joy, here's the exciting part. So here's the part about the midwives. Now let's actually read this because there's a few things that we need to note about what they said and what they didn't say, right? Now I'm just gonna be honest here. I am of the variety that thinks that the midwives actually didn't lie. I know. It's okay if you disagree with me. I hope you'll still be my friend. So here we go. Ready? Exodus chapter 1 and verse 15. It says here, "And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shiphrah, the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. If it be a daughter, then she shall live." So these are the instructions from Pharaoh. Just a couple of things to note. First thing that I really want to bring out here is they have Hebrew names. So I would highly suggest that these are Hebrews, not Egyptians. So we're looking, I think, at Hebrew women. It's not just that, you know, their names became Hebrew words, but they actually have Hebrew root words. So these are actual Hebrew names. So what happens here now is that Pharaoh, God put Israel into slavery to prevent assimilation, as we talked about last night, right? And Pharaoh now goes beyond that. Now he's not preventing assimilation. Now he's destroying the people of God. And that's not okay. He's gone beyond his commission by God. So, we now have the story of the midwives. So verse 17, "But the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive." Now, notice very carefully what it is that the midwives say is happening. Okay, that's important. What do they say is happening? Verse 18, "The king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have ye done this thing and have sinned and have saved the men children alive? The midwife said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them." All right. So, what is it that they put together? They come to Pharaoh and they say, the Hebrew women are lively, right? And they have babies before we can get there. So this is our problem. This is what's going on. So was all of that actually a lie? Well, here's some things to think about, right? The Egyptians are already scared of Hebrews because, you know, they think, oh, they're going to rebel against us. These people are like miraculously exploding into life, right? There's suddenly like thousands of these people, and we don't know how this is happening. So they are freaked out of the Hebrews already, and so the midwives come up and they're like, well, miraculous like explosion of life is happening, and so, you know, we can't reach the Hebrews before they're born. And we know God was making them have children quickly, so I mean, I don't have an issue with that. I think that's probably true. The other thing is that they say the Hebrews gives birth faster than the Egyptians, right? They're not like the Egyptian women. We can't get there fast enough. You know, we're running to, oh, birth, and then, oh, there's a baby, right? Like, you know, it's already there. And I know what that's like, by the way. So that, and it does happen that way. So, I actually tried, never mind. We won't go into it. But, yeah, better to move on. So, what I do want to bring out here is, I have to say, I'm not a medical person. No, I'm not going to say that either. Okay, I'm not a medical person. We'll leave it at that. So, here's just a couple of things to think about in relation to giving birth. Okay. We're talking about slaves, right? Slave women who are out there working all the time. Well, AmericanPregnancy.org, I think that sounds like a decent, you know, reliable source, says, some studies suggest that the fitness level of the mother can result in a shorter labor, fewer medical interventions, and less exhaustion during labor. Being in shape will not decrease the pain, but it will definitely help give you the endurance you need to get through labor. Okay, so it shortens it. This is usnews.com. Some of the best outcomes associated with exercise during pregnancy occur when activity continues as late into the pregnancy as possible. Documented benefits include reduced risk of premature labor and very small birth weights, substantially decreased need for operative intervention and pain management, and ready? Shorter labor. So maybe it could be that, number one, we know God was causing the children of Israel to have a lot of children. And I think if he's causing them to do that, it's not weird to me that he's causing them to have children fast, right? And on top of that, people who are slaves are out working all day, and it is demonstrated that people who are working all day and who are fit and exercising have shorter labors. So maybe the midwives didn't lie. Okay? Just think it's important to think about that. But emphasis on the word maybe. And so the issue was that because of that, they couldn't make it look like an accident, right? That's what they're saying to Pharaoh. Here's the issue. He says, when a baby boy is born, you know, you're supposed to get rid of it. And so they come in and they say, well, look, we show up and the boy's already born, right? So we can't get rid of him then. So Pharaoh actually at the beginning is trying to make the whole thing look like an accident, right? He wants it to be secret. That's why, you know, they couldn't just go up when the boy was born and get rid of the boy. They would come in, late, right? So they couldn't do something while the baby was being born. So Pharaoh says then, all right, well, fine, whatever. Forget the midwives thing. That didn't work. Instead, we're just going to throw all the babies into the river. So this is what he commands his people to do. Exodus 1:22, he talks to all of his people, and he says, throw the children into the river. If you see a male Hebrew child, take it, throw it in the river. Just think about what this would have been like. Right? Have you tried to picture what this was? I mean, maybe you don't really want to, but I think it's helpful for recognizing this is what Moses is born into, right? There would have been people roaming the streets listening for children. Parents would be hiding their children, and the Hebrews are actually forced to reveal them. This is something that we find out in Acts. So in Acts chapter 7, here's what Stephen says. Acts 7, verses 18 to 19. He says, till another king arose, which knew not Joseph, right? So we're in the same time period. The same dealt subtly, just like the serpent, with our kindred, and evil entreated our fathers, this is the phrase that we want to notice, so that they cast out their young children, to the end they might not live. Now that sounds really weird. It sounds like, you know, they're throwing their children somewhere. And that's not quite, I think, what the Greek actually is saying. If you look at Young's literal says, this one, talking about Pharaoh, having dealt subtly with our kindred, did evil to our fathers, causing to expose their babies. Right? So what we're talking about is this is an actual kind of thing of people searching for children. It's not just like, oh, I randomly saw a Hebrew boy. Hey, I need him. Right? It wasn't like that. It was people going into houses and looking. So he caused them to expose their babies so that they might not live. Green's literal translation says the same thing, causing their infants to be exposed. The English Standard says, forced our fathers to expose their infants. So, here's how we're going to wrap this up. Wow, I must have talked fast. Here's how we're going to wrap it up. God does not forget what is done to his people. There's a lot of times in life when you think revenge would be sweet. When you think, I really didn't deserve what that person just did to me. How can I get them back? Or, I wish I could get them back. Maybe you know, right? You know, I shouldn't take vengeance, but oh man, how good it would be, right? If they just like fell over and made themselves look ridiculous, or you know, whatever it might be. Like I would love to see that, haha, or something, right? Maybe you think that way. Sometimes I do. Maybe you only think about it sometimes, whatever. God, however, is the one who brings vengeance, right? And I think it's interesting because we know that vengeance is wrong, and so we often stray from this idea of vengeance. However, it's important to note that it really is God's realm, right? God will bring vengeance someday. He does not forget what people do to his children. And so, it's a good thing when it's done by him. So Isaiah 35, verse 4, right, this is our hymn. He comes in vengeance, but not for thee, right? Isaiah 35, verse 4, God's coming in vengeance. Isaiah 61 and verse 2. Let's take a look at that one. Isaiah 61, verse 2. And I want to emphasize this because I think sometimes we get this mistaken idea that all vengeance is bad. You know, I think it's a Christian idea that has crept in through the Christian churches that you know, anybody that has that you know thinks that vengeance is a good thing, well, then they clearly don't understand what love really means, you know, something like that. But in fact, this is clearly a scriptural thing. Verse 2, Isaiah 61, verse 2, this is all about the Messiah. This is prophesied of the Lord Jesus Christ. He quotes it in Luke chapter 4 when he's in the synagogue. Isaiah 61 and verse 2 says that Christ comes to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, the day of vengeance of our God. So the coming of Christ is the day of vengeance. And I think that's because God loves his servants. Now, just consider this, God's vengeance on Egypt. You remember what God calls Israel in Exodus chapter 4? It's his message to Pharaoh, and he says, you are touching my firstborn son. And he says, watch out, because I will do the same to your firstborn son. And so in fact, he does. However, what I think you should notice, by the way, is that it's slightly different. Because what God does in his vengeance, and I think that this is amazing. And this, for me, was a big theme that came out of the workbook. I don't know if you felt this way, too, in going through it. But it was this idea that God will never lose. Right? You do something, and God can do it back like 150 times greater. Right? Even more than that. Right? So Pharaoh says, oh yeah, I'll throw all your kids into the river, right? All your little babies. And God says, okay, fine. That's great. Well, I'll kill all of your firstborn, including the men who are grown up and the animals, right? You killed little baby boys who were being born, and well, I'm going to kill everything that's a firstborn. So this is what God does. This is God's vengeance, right? He will not be outdone. He will not forget what is done to his people. And so, then, he takes it even further. Because Pharaoh threw the babies into the river, right? Just notice this. Let's read Exodus chapter 14. Exodus 14. Starting at verse 27. Listen for God's vengeance outdoing what Pharaoh did. Exodus chapter 14, verse 27, it says, Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to his strength when the morning appeared. The Egyptians fled against it, and the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. Do you see what God did to Egypt for throwing the children into the river? I mean, it's almost like, oh, wow, Pharaoh, you can defeat babies. Wow, big deal, right? Like, well, you're going to throw them into the river. Well, I'm going to throw your whole army, your strong men, your guys who think, we can take anything, right? Well, I'll throw them all into the ocean, right? Like, you did a river, I'll do the ocean. You did babies, I'll do your strongest men. And so that's what God does. There remained not so much as one of them. And you know why that's significant. Because with Pharaoh, there was still one who survived. And that was Moses. But God outdid Pharaoh. Our God does not forget the injustices that are done to his children. Can you turn to Isaiah 63? I think that this is something that we don't often think about, right? Vengeance is something that we don't really talk about very much. And at the same time, connected to that is the reason why God's vengeance is right. Here's why. And I think this should really put us in awe of who our God is. So our context here is we're talking about the Exodus, right? So it's the same time period. Isaiah 63. And let's take a look at, let's start at verse 7. Verse 7 says, I will mention the loving kindnesses of the Lord and the praises of the Lord according to all that the Lord hath bestowed on us and the great goodness toward the house of Israel, which he hath bestowed on them according to his mercies, according to the multitude of his loving kindnesses. For he said, surely they are my people, children that will not lie. So he was their Savior. So it's talking all about God's love and his mercy towards Israel. And in that context here, talking about the Exodus, verse 9, listen to this. Just try and fathom what this means. In all their affliction, he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and in his pity, he redeemed them, and he bare them and carried them all the days of old. In all their affliction, he was afflicted. Can you think about what that means? That means that when an Israelite picked up one too many bricks and fell over from exhaustion, that God felt that pain. That means that when the whip came down on an Israelite's back in Egypt, that God felt the whip, right? In all of their affliction, he was afflicted. He felt the pain that they were going through. I don't think we should forget that. Because really, sometimes we get stuck on this question of, why does God allow suffering, right? I mean, we look at the children of Israel in Egypt. Why does he allow slavery for all these years? Why does God allow suffering? And one of the amazing things to think about is that, in fact, we should be in awe of the fact that God does allow suffering. Because in all of our affliction, he is afflicted. He suffers with us. And so he endures all of that for our sake, knowing that when we are chastened, it prepares us for his kingdom. He endures our chastening so that we can be in his kingdom. Just think about that. I don't mean that in any kind of weird substitutionary way. I hope that doesn't sound that way. But he feels it. He empathizes with it. And so you can see this story of, we don't have to go there, but it's John chapter 11. This is the story of Lazarus' resurrection. And it says right at the beginning of the chapter, and Jesus loved Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, right? He loved them. And so, we read the story about Lazarus, and this was always our favorite memory verse growing up, right? John 11:35, Jesus wept. But have you ever thought about why that happens? It happens because Jesus gets to Bethany, and Mary runs up to him, and she says to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. This is what she says to him, right? She's She's falling apart about this because she says, you could have saved him, right? And he sees her weeping. He sees the Jews weeping, and the Jews say, could not this man have saved Lazarus? And he opened the eyes of the blind. And it's as he sees Mary's weeping, and as he recognizes her pain, that we get our verse, Jesus wept. Don't forget the context of your favorite memory verse. This is a verse that tells us about the way in which the Lord Jesus empathizes with our pain. And so God doesn't forget. The Lord Jesus does not forget. Luke 18, verses 7 to 8, and shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you, he will avenge them speedily. And so as we close this up, we talked yesterday about how true humility recognizes that God's ways are higher than man's. Tonight, let's recognize that true humility accepts and waits for God's vengeance, not ours, knowing that our hearts are in the hands of one who is afflicted with us.